If we're going to meet our most pressing sustainability challenges and tackle climate change, we've got to find smarter ways to get our energy, our food, our housing, all of it. More often than not, that means we've got to figure out new ways to do things all the way down at the molecular level. But that research takes time, and most would argue that time is not on our side. In this episode of Green Chem Essential, how researchers are using artificial intelligence and machine learning to potentially speed up these vital discoveries, and thereby shorten the path to the sustainability and climate change solutions that we so dearly need. I'm James Ray, and my guest is Dr. Alexei Lapkin, Professor of Sustainable Reaction Engineering at the University of Cambridge. Alexei Lapkin, thank you very much for joining me today.
Hi, James. Thanks for inviting.
All right. So if we look at the challenge that you're trying to address with your work regarding machine learning and artificial intelligence in tackling the opportunities and challenges in green chemistry, what are the challenges? What is the challenge that you are trying to address here? You know, where are people experiencing the kind of chemistry you're talking about that maybe isn't front of mind for folks?
Well, probably one of the first things you do in the morning is you go and take a shower, and then your shampoos and your hair conditioner. Well, the hair conditioner is basically a bunch of polymers with very specific properties, certain charges which then stick to your hair and make it shiny and so on. This is just pure chemistry. There is nothing else there. This is sort of the area of physical chemistry. But the green chemistry come into this because you have a choice what those polymers are made from and what happens with them once you wash them off into the water system. Are they degradable? Are they easily biodegraded by the water purification system, or they are discarded then some way into the ocean and then leave there forever? So whether they're persistent chemicals or biodegradable and so on. So this is kind of an immediate thing, but then the clothes you wear, the food you eat, there's a lot of chemistry in pretty much everything. Your computers, your cars, everything is pretty much started with the chemical innovation.
If that's the opportunity that we're dealing with here in green chemistry, what's the challenge you're trying to solve? There's incredible innovation that's at potential here, but...
Well, the traditional way of developing new chemistries and new chemical processes has always been on trial and error basis. The chemical knowledge is kind of a very obscure thing. There are some theories, but not that many. A lot of chemistry is you have to have an intuition why certain things work. It takes a long time for synthetic chemists to become great, I would say, because synthetic procedures are almost like an intuition why this will react with that and what magic does to add to your synthesis that is going to work. And I'm a very, very bad chemist in that sense that I can't do that. Others can. However, that is the fact that there is this intuition implies that this is perfect for machine learning, because that's what machine learning does. It actually, looking at the data sets, trying to find why certain things correlate with others and what is that kind of underlying law within the data. So we've had a hypothesis that by using techniques from statistical machine learning and then from reasoning AI, we should be able to speed up the process of developing both molecules, synthetic plants, new processes. And then we can ask questions about replacement, sort of changing the feedstocks, changing the molecules used in synthesis, looking at similar but not toxic molecules to perform the function. So you have all of these questions of the, we call it inverse problem. So you know what the function you want to perform, but what's the molecule which does that function so that it does the function, but it's also non-toxic. It's also biodegradable or something else. So you have lots of properties, or it comes from biofeedstocks. So you kind of need to have that relationship between all of the demands you put on the synthesis with how to do it.
It's this idea of machine learning, and as you said, then the additional reasoning of AI to hopefully speed up the discovery of these new options, right? Is that to make the finding of the products that are both functional and meet the requirements of environment and sustainability and climate change? to fit that window if more quickly?
Yeah, so one is do this much faster, and it's important for medicines and for other products, for example. The other is to also look at the wider chemical space, because actually the number of molecules we are dealing with in the commercial sense is relatively small, whereas the potential chemical space is significantly larger, and it's pretty much largely unexplored.
Yeah. And I think, if it's okay, you, when we talked earlier, you gave me an example with your company that's using this technology, and you don't need to give up any sort of proprietary, you know, no, you don't mean mention any names or specifics, but just in a general sense, if you're okay but talking about it, there was a sort of a case study you gave me of trying to, you know, fit a pretty narrow window that someone's asking for. Are you okay, as a way to understand this challenge for folks to understand this challenge, what you've been asked to do, is that, and again, in a general sense?
Yeah, I will return to an example which we are not doing, because okay. I can talk about that.
Okay.
If you go back to, let's say, shampoo example, and you have a really very narrow window of conditions where your chemistry can perform. For example, pH, sort of the acidity or basicity of your shampoo, cannot be deviating much from 7, which is water, because you're putting it on your head, right? So you cannot put anything too acidic or too basic, because you're going to go bald much faster. So and in this case, if you are developing new formulations, they have to have a very, very specific range of performance characteristics about how they look. Are they transparent and not transparent? How they perform during the washing? Because you take shampoo, it's concentrated. Then you put it on your head, it's diluted a little bit. And then you're washing it, it's diluted even more. And the performance has to stay in a specific range. This is really, really complex task of hitting that specification of the performance. And this is very hard task. And this exists in many performance chemicals. The same exists in medicines. You need a molecule which affects the target, which is either a protein or something else, but doesn't kill you, doesn't cause your liver to fail, is absorbed by the body, can have a specific lifetime in the body. And there's so many different things. It's not metabolized into something toxic in your body.
Sure.
It's not co-metabolized with anything you eat. There is so many different characteristics you need for a design of a medicinal molecule. These are really, really hard targets to put together. It makes the task much, much harder if you want to hit all of these targets together.
And then, with the green chemistry lens, we add in the things that you mentioned at the very top of this, which is, you know, the really important and increasingly important considerations of biodegradability, non-toxic to the people who are making it, the users, or the plants and animals and air and soil, you know, when it gets washed down the drain or whatever happens. So all those characteristics, are that tight window of characteristics of function, economics, and environmental and climate considerations, starts to create a pretty tight window of performance. So with your work to find something that fits in that window, take it away.
Okay. So what I wanted to say is, if you start sort of adding those constraints on the demand, on more and more demands on the product, you kind of may end up in a situation that, well, you can't do it. It's just too much. You need a performance, you need a biodegradability, you need lower cost. So it's just not possible. So what we're trying to do is to find methods which actually look for those solutions, finding the global optimum, let's say. So what is the best possible structure which gives you the best chance of having something biodegradable and performing? So going away from those ideas that this is always a compromise. Let's find some radical solutions which are not compromises, which just take you away from the usual way of thinking. So one of the great things about machine learning and AI is that it has its own biases, but typically it removes your human sort of biases of generally tend to go for the same chemistry you've always done or the same process you've always done because you know it's safe, you know how it's going to work. Whereas if you go to ML-based methods, you have access to all of the data and then you're much less biased. There are other types of biases there, but
sure.
Remove the more common ones, which is your experience bias in developing something in the professional work.
So in uncovering, you set it up wonderfully, just uncovering replacing that we can't do it with certainly we can, there's innovations out there we haven't thought of yet. Take us now, and if it's okay with you, I think we'll tackle machine learning and then AI as the solution to this. So, machine learning to start with,
okay.
With all the complexity out there and the things you're trying to analyze to fit that window of performance and offer a yes, we can do it rather than this is too hard. What is machine learning doing? What are you doing with machine learning that starts to solve that challenge?
So the first thing is analyzing the data. So looking at, let's say, performance chemicals, we're looking at what do we know about the function? How does it come from a structure of a molecule or some physical principles? Understanding how do we parameterize molecules to describe what do they actually do? So that if we then have a machine learning model which is trained on data, which can predict how known already molecules perform, we can then expand it and start searching for unknown molecules. Of course, this comes with a certain amount of certainty. It's not like a guaranteed 100% you're going to get the result. You're going to get the result with certain error. But it is a way of learning what are the principles when the principles are maybe too many to discern from theory. And understand how do you get to the right sort of sweet spot.
So, and I love that when the sort of the variabilities or the principles are, I think you said too many to discern from theory. So I if I'm right, that sort of takes us back to, as you mentioned, you know, the current sort of iterative process of chemistry and using intuition and a ton of skill at the bench with chemists trying different things based on what they know, but there's the variety of options it's takes too long, frankly.
And well,
based on what we're trying to accomplish here, yeah. Right? Is that
if you stay in mechanics, and this is why airplanes are flying and so on, aerodynamics, the laws of physics are very clear. We understand them, and developing a simulator based on laws of physics to fly a plane or describe how billiard balls move on the table is a no-brainer, and they will mm-hmm. be very accurate and very predictive. You go to molecules and things become a lot fuzzier because sometimes we don't know why certain things happen. We have hypotheses, but there are many of them, and some of them are incorrect. We don't know which ones. And so in this environment where some theories exist but not all, predicting based on physical principles is not very likely.
Is that because I think in your, and folks, I'll link to this in the video, there's a wonderful paper that Alexei and his colleagues wrote outlining all of this. I think in that you mentioned that paper references sort of six dimensions of complexity to this, where when you put, as you said, a pertinent molecule in one situation, how it's going to react against some chemicals, and then you add a third or a fourth, and I mean, where the just the complexity of interactions between what might be in that tank making shampoo or whatever it be, how things are going to play out in those settings starts to become harder and harder to predict. Is that correct? Am I getting anywhere,
anywhere
close to the accuracy here?
We didn't rehearse this, but you picked my favorite topic, so I'm going to stay on it like forever. So it's all unfortunate you picked up my favorite topic.
But in terms of that complexity, is that what we're talking about here? Where we can understand a molecule, but the minute you put it in again, the vat where you're making that shampoo, how it's going to react with whatever else you put in there, the complexity just starts to magnify.
Yeah, the shampoo is a good example because you're dealing with polymers rather than simple molecules. Polymers, of course, are mixtures. They are not just one chain. There are mixtures of chains. They are commercial polymers, which means that they have big variations of the polymer chains, and you quite often don't even know what's in there properly. Mm-hmm. There are some impurities and so on. And doing predictions on this kind of systems is just not possible. From first principles, if you think that you can compute this, that's not going to happen.
And the prediction, forgive me for interrupting, but I just want to make sure folks keep this tethered to that challenge you outlined, which is, you know, the meeting the performance and cost and environmental. And it comes down to, if you're trying to develop a safer, cleaner, more sustainable solution, then we are talking about trying to predict those things.
Everything, yes.
Which becomes so challenging. And so, again, bringing it back to your machine learning, am I right that at the basic level, you're using machine learning to find the patterns? Use tons of data to find patterns to these interactions, and a database of those patterns faster than a human could sitting at a bench?
In the simplistic terms, yes. So you have the sort of sum of the, from the theory of computer science, neural networks are universal approximators. If you have enough data, you can train a neural network to perfectly describe your reality, your data. And in chemistry, you typically don't have that much data, so you go for other models rather than neural networks. I mean, the wonderful example today, language models are basically deep neural networks. So you can describe language, you just need to have big enough neural network and very, very, very large amount of compute power to train it.
Yeah.
So you can eventually describe something very, very complex as language with all of its structures and meanings and so on and so on. The same would apply to chemistry. The reason for doing it is really to substitute the fact that we can't combine all of these theories, and we don't have enough theories to do it from first principles. And sometimes first principles calculations are just too slow. You can't do it. If you want to do quantum chemistry calculations, you can, but for complex molecules, it will just take absolutely forever. And they will not be very accurate. And so we're trying to speed this up to make sure we have approximations of those with machine learning models, and then have machine learning models sufficiently flexible so we can extrapolate for new chemical structures.
And forgive me if I'm misunderstanding it, because that's entirely possible. That extrapolation piece, is that what then takes machine learning into the artificial intelligence realm? Is that
not necessarily?
Let me ask it this way, I guess. If machine learning is helping you to sort of document and recognize and predict patterns at a more complex level of the molecules that folks might choose for products, where does artificial intelligence or AI as sort of the next step to that, as you're working on it, where does that take us?
Well, first of all, a caveat, I'm not the world's best expert in AI. Let's say the delineation which I take from literature and from some of my colleagues who are the best people in AI is when we talk about AI is much more about reasoning. You have sort of concepts already embedded, you have logic embedded, and then the algorithms can manipulate with the concepts and the logic. So the way we do it is we try to generalize knowledge in such a way that the algorithms understand it. So let's say I give you an example. We have a machine learning model which designs a chemical plant. So it puts together components of a chemical plant. It does it somehow. It arrives at the solution, and we like the solution. It's the most economical and the best one we've ever seen. It's better than the human done. But then we ask a question, why that solution? What makes that special? And that sort of knowledge, if you just use machine learning like neural networks, the neural network is not typically explainable. You can't understand why that solution is good. So we need to figure out how to express the solution in a way that is the knowledge can be extracted. And then you can use AI codes, which are then able to deal with the knowledge components, the data, the relationships between data, ask different reasoning questions, and then kind of take next steps. So this is much more in the domain of artificial intelligence rather than statistical machine learning.
So in your example of creating that manufacturing process using machine learning, create the most efficient process. Yeah. And it does it. And then my interpretation of what you said is it did a great job, but is that then replicable? Can you get sort of the reasoning out of it to say, okay, this is why it was developed this way, so we can go do it again and again and again more efficiently?
Yeah, so there is a technique in AI which is called reinforcement learning. This is like almost like a game theory. You have a like to chemical plant design. You have all of your toys, all the possible unit operations and connections between them. This is like your playground, and you set the code to let's play with it, find the solution or find the way how to get to the answer, which is the most optimal solution. And this reinforcement code does that, but then we need to understand why that solution. But the reason why we want to understand it is because the reinforcement learning process is actually quite expensive to run. It will run the simulation thousands of times.
Okay.
And if the underlying models are quite difficult to run, it may be weeks on a high performance computer. And so you don't want to do it every time because it's also quite costly in terms of emissions. If you've learned why under certain circumstances you get this specifically good solutions, you can do it much faster next time.
When that last piece, I want to make sure I heard correctly, because that's a really interesting point. When you started in terms of emissions, are you talking about like just computer processing power? Is that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's a lot of the more we do AI and the more we use AI-based models or machine learning-based models, the more compute power you require. And this comes at the cost, right?
That's okay. So folks, just again, and Alexei, please correct me if my distillation of this is not correct, because that's a really fascinating, I think, because it also solves, as you were describing that in the first time around, I'm thinking, well, why not just run the program again and again? If you want to, for example, recreate those, you know, another manufacturing plant, why do you need the reasoning if the computer can just do it each time? And I think what you're saying, and this is a really interesting point, again, in a larger sustainability point, folks, is, as anyone watching this probably has already heard or knows, the beauty of computing power is that it's allowing us to do things like this that are helping to solve our climate change and sustainability problems. The challenge is that while doing that, these computers, these server farms, et cetera, are using a ton of electricity. They have their own climate impact. So what Alexei's saying, and again, Alexei, fix anything I get wrong, is that if you can run the AI program or the process as few, it's running it is important to get the information out to create a better design system for the chemicals we need that are more sustainable. But the less you can run, you have to run that system through a computer system for their own emissions problems, the better. Is that?
Yeah. I would say so. Certainly trying to avoid some of the routine stuff. Sometimes people run calculations and, it's easy. It's just run it on somewhere in a cluster. But that actually means that there is an emission associated with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And as a side note, folks, again, a subject of a future episode guaranteed is going to be the areas of green chemistry where people are trying to, you know, both on the computer side, or at least adjacent to green chemistry, on the computer side, how computing that doesn't require as much electricity, and on the electricity side, supplying that electricity in more efficient and sustainable ways, all of which, again, finds its solutions in green chemistry.
Good green chemistry principle, doing less is better, right?
Yeah, exactly. All right. So I want to kind of bring us back around, if I could. And I think, Alexei, forgive me if this is not a good way to sort of start to help sum up everything you're doing, or if, again, it's not something you, based on sort of, you know, trade secret work that's going forward for you all. It has to do with the bio waste stream work you're doing. Can you talk about that in the context of a recorded interview?
Yeah,
because I think it encapsulates, I think, It's another hard example, I think, of the work you're doing that will make sense to folks. Is that something you can talk about or not so much?
No. I think I'm quite happy to talk about it. I mean, waste is an important thing. In the concept of chemistry, we're trying to make sure there is no waste. So we're looking at sort of circular economy type principles when the molecules are reused. And actually, this is the reason why I set up a company, because my company has technology to trace the molecules in the value chain. So we can understand how the structures are transformed, where do they go, where they can be reused again. And we are involved in a public project, well, publicly funded project with pharma industry to design better ways of estimating the environmental impact of pharmaceuticals manufacturing. So they're creating software codes basically to speed up this kind of calculations. And then this is aimed at the designer. So as soon as the chemical synthesis is proposed, then you can run the code and say, okay, that's going to be your emissions. And by the way, this is how you can make sure you don't have them, or this is not a problem because actually this byproducts are going to be reused. So this is sort of the software codes which we are building are aimed at this kind of design stage, so that you really can use green chemistry principles forcefully, I would say, in the work.
Yeah. Well, and it's an interesting one, I think, because, you know, again, for the audience watching, and again, please, Lexi, correct me for anything I get wrong here once again. The idea of the bio waste streams, so waste streams coming out of different manufacturing processes, whether it's beer or a paper manufacturing, or I think you mentioned pharmaceuticals. One of the big opportunities really in green chemistry is finding alternative feedstocks to recreate the next molecule, getting away from petroleum as the feedstock that currently is the foundation for a stunning array of the chemicals we use, and finding bio-based solutions. And a lot of those bio-based solutions can be found presently in the waste streams of other production processes.
Yeah, I so need that to correct these, so a little bit waste terminology.
Yeah, please. Right. Yeah.
So when you say bio-based, I don't mean necessarily biotechnology. Biotechnology is basically fermentation, right? What you're talking about is you have complex mixtures coming out of bio waste, so like agriculture or municipal waste and so on, which are complex mixtures which have complex molecules in them. Those could be used as a feedstocks, but there are also bio manufacturing. Let's say you use technology to make artificial meat, right? Or you use a technology to make monoclonal antibodies. These are biotechnology. This is where you use cells and so on, you engineer them, and of course you have waste at the end. Yeah. So you have to treat it. If that waste is from a pharma company, by regulation you cannot do anything with that apart from burn it, because it's highly toxic and it might be gene regulated and so on. So you just can't do anything with it apart from basically produce energy. But if it comes from other streams, you can. And this is where this is now considered as a future very valuable feedstock for the industry.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Where folks can, and back to the waste stream, the software you're working on to look at those waste streams, and again more rapidly, more efficiently extract the information so that folks can make use of those as feedstocks rather than having it simply be waste.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
That's pretty much what we're working on. Yeah.
Fantastic. There's a piece to this that I want to ask you, because again, I think I read it in your paper, and I want to make sure I understood it correctly. It has to do with sort of proprietary versus sort of open. Is there an aspect to this in terms of looking forward in the work that you're doing? I'm talking about the data that's being gathered and how that data is going to be processed and put to use to find green chemistry ideas and designs faster. This proprietary versus open, and where you all are headed with this idea, is that
it is a very complex and a very active discussion in the chemistry context. You can imagine that some information about what we do cannot be made entirely public, because you can use an AI algorithm to design you a bioweapon, sorry, a chemical weapon, not bio, but chemical weapon. It's entirely plausible, and some people have shown it in the literature that you can do it. So there is this aspect. There is another aspect which we talked about in the paper, which is about trade secrets. How do you do stuff in the industry? Many of the chemical companies operate on trade secrets rather than patents. It's not the same as computer science or products. So dealing with this is challenging. But computer science community is coming up with solutions. So there are now specific even services on Amazon so that you can train models with data sitting in the kind of enclaves which are not shared between the owners of the data, but the model can access them, and so that you can train a machine learning model on proprietary data without breaking the confidentiality. So this is now becoming possible. So technology moves on and solves these kind of problems for us. So we're looking at these areas, and there was a pharma project recently run on that type of idea, how to train models on proprietary data.
So that's really interesting. So I want to make sure I'm understanding it. The idea is that, you know, one pharma company whose livelihood depends on that trade secret isn't going to just say, hey, I know you're trying to develop something too, here's our secret. That's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is, let's say I'm imagining sort of like an opaque tank sitting between them where the secrets are being deposited, and company B can dip its computer toe into that tank. And without needing to know the proprietary secrets of that company, can use some of the foundational knowledge to more rapidly develop their green chemistry idea. Is that?
I think you're a little bit too far off from.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. How would we?
You have technology which develops a model, so it needs data for training. It just looks at the place, like in a computer, you have a folder, folder A, folder B. You can make one of your folders password protected, so even somebody in your house cannot access part of your data. So you have a model which knows the passwords, but nobody else knows the passwords. And so your model can look into these different things and create a model and then share it with everybody.
Okay.
So nobody knows your data underneath, but they know the results of the model can be used.
So a couple more steps removed from what I said, but the resulting idea being that there's an openness at least to some of the foundational innovation possibilities that's going to help green chemistry solutions move ahead faster.
So you're right, but at the same time, this is using the proprietary data because there is a lot of it in chemistry. But at the same time, there are now efforts to create open data sets. So there is a open reaction database project out of MIT. There is a big project in Germany to create an open reaction database. So these things are also existing. So they are in parallel. It's just you can recreate all of the new data, but it's going to take an effort. So if there are already all of these data sets in behind paywall or behind trade secrets, maybe we can make use of them as well in parallel.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, all in service, again, just to, you know, where we are is all in service to helping people, as you said, meet those going forward, the demands of green chemistry, the demands of society, I should say, are that products and processes be made to be more healthy for the environment and humans, help not exasperate or perhaps likely even help solve climate change challenges.
So looking for molecules which we haven't looked for before, like in energy materials, or look for drugs which will cure you and not kill you and not do something. Just avoiding mistake for in medicine, avoiding mistakes we've done before, so that quite often molecules were withdrawn from the market because you later find out that it has side effects or something else, or you develop a molecule and you can't manufacture it. Avoiding this kind of stuff, which is basically wastage of human effort. Yeah. So this is where what we're doing is really geared at these kind of challenges.
Terrific. Well, Alexei, thank you very much. This is a fascinating topic, and I know there's like countless more. I have countless more questions I'd like to ask you, but maybe we'll save that for another episode where we dive yet deeper into this. I want to thank you for joining us. I should offer you any closing words if we look at this, again, the broader picture of the challenges we face, the opportunities that green chemistry offers. But how, the ideas you're working on can help accelerate those solutions, the ways to make things and process things, source things from feedstocks that are better. Any closing thoughts on sort of this universe of ideas?
I think it's all about the data and the knowledge and making data knowledge accessible to a wider community, making tools available to people so that there is ingenuity of much broader group of people involved in this and really taking it to commercial reality in the end. And for people who are keen on develop startups and make money on this, because it is going to revolutionize the chemistry, and somebody has to do it. So
that's fantastic. I love the idea you just mentioned, because I think in summary, to some extent, everyone else that I go forth to interview in this series for Green Chem Essential, the innovators in labs, the folks doing startups, the folks in larger chemical companies, I think down the road are going to be benefiting from the kind of work you're doing. And it's sort of the accelerator pedal on the work that everyone else is doing. And that's a pretty powerful and cool idea. So thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the opportunity.